All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Chief Judge William P. Green, Jr. presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this court. You may be seated.
Good morning. The court is convened to hear the case of Fithian versus Shinseki. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, will counsel representing the appellant state his name for the record?
David Allred, A-L-L-R-E-D.
Welcome, Mr. Allred. And for the government.
Good morning. On behalf of the Secretary, Pamela Nash, and Deputy Assistant General Counsel, Richard Merrick.
Good morning. Mr. Allred, you have 30 minutes to present your argument. Do you wish to reserve any of that time?
Yes, sir. May I reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal?
All right. Now, before we begin, Mr. Allred, are you familiar with Rule 30 of the Court's Rules of Practice and Procedure?
I don't recall that rule by number, but I have read all of the rules.
Okay. It's come to my attention that this morning the marshal brought to me some cases, and I didn't have a letter to the clerk or any indication that these matters had been served on the secretary.
Now I know what you're talking about. Yes, sir. I found those cases, the two cases that I gave to the fellow to give to the court, and I've given copies of the cases to the secretary as well.
And these are not recent cases?
They are not recent cases.
Well, I remind you that when you take action such as that you need to look at the rules of practice and procedure and ensure that you comply with them fully.
Yes, sir.
Very well. You may proceed.
May I please?
Chief?
Yes.
As a procedural matter, I'd like the Secretary's counsel to know that I did not read the supplemental authority in as much as it came to us, and I believe to be in an attempt at ex parte communication. And therefore, I have not read the memorandum or whatever it purports to be. So my actions will not be influenced by this late run at submission of authority. Does Judge Pryor on the 11th Circuit allow folks to come in the morning of argument and submit supplemental authority?
Your Honor, my experience in the 11th Circuit when I was there practicing was that counsel could make any arguments based on case law that counsel thought was appropriate during the course of oral arguments. Let me assure the court that I didn't attempt to have an ex parte communication with the court. In fact, as I said, I found these cases this weekend, and once I found those cases, I brought them to court this morning, and at the same time that I delivered them to the court, I also tried at that time to deliver them to Ms. Nash. I did get them to her later on after I got the two cases to the court.
Well, I know, Mr. Allred, that this is a pro bono representation on your part, number one, and number two, you're on a temporary license with this court. So no harm, no foul, but mark it down on your tennis shoes.
I understand, and again, I apologize for the court for not getting those cases, both to the court and to the secretary at an earlier date.
Thank you.
Understand, Mr. Allred, it's not just the timing, it's the format as well. The cases came to us as copies of cases with no indication that the secretary had been served and with no cover letter from you.
I understand what the court's saying, and I assure you that won't happen again. All I can do is tell you that I apologize.
I understand.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. Mr. Fithian submits that there are really three issues that we would like to discuss today. The first is whether or not the letter that he mailed on July the 21st of 2008 to the BVA was, in fact, falls within the mailbox rule. The second issue is one that the court specifically asked that we address, and that is whether or not that letter would, in fact, constitute a motion for reconsideration. And the third issue that I would like to discuss is the impact of Henderson on the court's decision about whether or not a misfiled motion for reconsideration can, in fact, toll the 120-day appellate notice for appeal.
Counsel, I'd actually like to hear about the Henderson issue first.
The position that we take with respect to Henderson is, first of all, that it's somewhat opaque and unclear as to exactly what ruling Henderson was making with respect to the underlying question of the misfiling of the motion for reconsideration.
So the language in Henderson that says expressly overrule Jacquet and Bailey is unclear?
That's not unclear. What the basis for their overruling Jacquet is more unclear. With respect to Bailey, I don't think it's quite as unclear, because Bailey was a situation where you had the standard tolling, where in Bailey the veteran simply didn't get his notice of appeal to the court within the 120-day time frame.
That's correct. But in Jacquet, like here, the mailing went to the RO.
Absolutely.
So the facts are very similar.
The facts are very, very similar. My argument is that in Henderson, they didn't specifically address Rosler and the impact of Rosler in saying that you can, in effect, abate or toll the time period if you file a motion for consideration with the BVA. So I guess what I'm saying is, when I read Henderson and went through it several times, Henderson specifically dwells on the fact that the 120-day period for a notice of appeal is a statutory grant made by Congress. They also, at one point in Henderson, make a distinction between a time limit that's set by statute and a time limit, and I believe the case they were talking about was a rule in bankruptcy court, which is a time limit that's set by a court. They talk about those two as being different. I submit that here, the time limit that's set by Congress is statutory, and the provision for a motion for reconsideration is something that's addressed by a regulatory, by the VA, by the Code of Federal Regulations, and that there's a difference there. Similar to the time limit that would be set by a court that's referenced in Henderson. So that's one argument that I would make, is that without being more specific about what aspects of Jacquet the court was overruling, that it's not that clear. I would note in that regard that in the court's decision in Posey versus Shinseki, the court made an observation when talking about the fact that Mr. Posey misfiled his, well, actually in that case it wasn't a misfiled motion for reconsideration. It was, that case involved whether or not, like was the court ultimately decided a motion for reconsideration, whether or not it was a notice of appeal. But the court in its decision talks about Jacquet and cites favorably to the fact that Jacquet said that this place of filing the motion was only for the administrative convenience of the Veterans Administration. And furthermore, said in that context, Jacquet overruled on other grounds. Now, honestly, I looked at Henderson as closely as I can, and it's hard for me to argue with the clear language where they say they have overruled Jacquet.
Was there any rationale in the Henderson decision that addressed the filing of a motion for reconsideration at VA?
I didn't see anything in the opinion that explained to me why they said that you would have to file it with the BVA instead of with the regional office. That was the thing that made me say the decision is somewhat opaque with respect to exactly what elements of Jockway are overruled, especially in the context that Henderson didn't involve that at all. Henderson was similar to Bailey in having a notice of appeal that simply was never filed on time.
So is it that the only language in Henderson that has a relevance to Jockway were the terms equitable tolling?
That's true, but of course, as the court knows, the Henderson court said that Jockway said there was equitable tolling with respect to a misfiling of the motion for reconsideration.
And that's what Jockway said, wasn't it?
Well,
or did Jockway really have to say that?
Jockway, actually, in a footnote to Jockway, it said that although we have throughout here referred to a Rossler equitable tolling, it's really not an equitable tolling. It's an abatement that doesn't toll the statute. It abates the statute until there's ultimately a decision made on the motion for reconsideration. And that's one of the reasons that I'm saying that I found Henderson unclear on that point, because they never even talk about the whole doctrine behind Rossler. So to say that they're overruling that aspect of Jockway, it seems to me that they would address the underlying element, which is Rossler. So what I'm telling you is that it's not my reading of the decision was that it was not entirely clear what the basis was for overruling Jockway, and again, particularly since that case is factually easily distinguishable from both Henderson and from Bailey. So I wish I could illuminate the court more clearly on what the underlying rationale was. And in fact, going back to Posey, I wish that I knew what the reason was that court said overruled on other grounds. I'd love to hear that rationale, because that's kind of the kind of argument that I'm making here, is maybe it was overruled on other grounds, because it's not clear to me. And I would have expected the court, if it was specifically dealing with that it would have talked more about Rossler and about why this regulation is somehow tied to the statutory time limit. And in fact, when I looked at that case, my thought was, if the Henderson court is strongly focusing on the statutory ground of immunity from sovereign immunity, repealing the sovereign immunity for this time frame, then, and that's the real emphasis of the court's decision, then how can it be that a regulation that's set by the Secretary of Veterans Affairs that could be changed tomorrow and say, you know what, you don't have to file this motion for reconsideration with the BVA, you can file it with the RO, or you can file it anywhere. And it seems, it doesn't seem consistent with the court's ruling that they're going to strictly look at what the statute, the Congress's statute says, and then yet pull in a regulation that the VA can change at any time. And now it wouldn't change the day, but it certainly, in any particular case, can change whether or not the notice of appeal would be timely. So if you look at that strict interpretation of Henderson, it seems to be that they're saying it would be okay for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to have a significant input on how a veteran's claim is going to be handled. And that just doesn't seem to me to be consistent with the vast majority of the rest of the opinion, where they so strongly rely on the Congress's statutory decision about the time limit.
Well, if we rule that Henderson does overrule Jacque on all grounds, then your letter or the appellant's letter to the RO then would just be out of, there would be no...
It would be out of time. That's right. It would mean...
For purposes of...
For purposes of an appeal to the court. I think, though, that letter did two things. Number one, it did constitute a motion for reconsideration. So the court could say, in basically what I'm going to ask the court to do in this case is remand the case back to the VA to consider that letter as a motion for reconsideration and make that remand without prejudice to his right to appeal. Because that gets back to the first point that the first issue that I raised, and that is whether or not the mailing of the letter on July the 21st was in fact falls within the mailbox rule.
How would it meet Rossler?
If he mailed the letter to the BVA on July the 21st, then that would ask...
I'm sorry, I thought it was received by the RO.
No, what happened, Your Honor, was on July the 21st, 2008, he sent a letter to the BVA. He didn't hear anything back from the BVA about that letter. So,
and the BVA has no record that the letter was received.
That's true, and the BVA has no record of the letter.
Right.
So on September the 8th, he sent a copy of that letter along with a supporting letter from his wife and two VA Form 9s to the RO. And my argument, and sent that to the RO, which was within the 120-day time, and we would be great if Jacque hadn't been overruled for whatever part of it was overruled. So my argument is that the original July 21st letter falls within the mailbox rule. And, of course, the mailbox rule says that the proponent of that has to establish by some evidence apart from what is characterized as a self-serving statement that he mailed the letter. And I would submit in this case that there is some evidence apart from what might be characterized as a self-serving statement, although I don't think it is a self-serving statement because of the time that he made it. What I'm saying is, when he sent that copy of that letter on September the 8th, still within the 120-day period, if he hadn't actually sent that letter to the BVA, why would he have included a copy of it to the RO? It doesn't make any sense. That letter that we have a copy of, we know that he knew that he had to send something to the BVA. So if he's still within the time frame, why would he even sent a copy of that letter to the RO if he hadn't already sent it to the BVA? Moreover, when he did get that letter back and was told to file a notice of appeal with this court, when he sent the letter, he filed his notice of appeal, and then the court ordered him to respond why his appeal should not be dismissed. So on October the 25th, he wrote a letter to the court saying, actually sending another copy of the original July the 21st letter to the court, along with a copy of his wife's letter in support, and I think he sent the VA 9 forms as well. And he says, here's a copy of the letter that I sent to the BVA back in July. Now, the reason I say that his statements are not self-serving when he says that is, at that time, he had absolutely no idea that at any time would it become material in any way that he sent the letter to the BVA on July the 21st.
What address did he send the letter to the BVA, Mr. Aldridge?
Your Honor, honestly, I don't know. He didn't have a copy of the envelope that he used to send the thing. I would argue that since the beginning of his claim in April of 2005, I think everything that he's done has been timely and been sent to the right office. You know, this case is, although he's appealing the decision with respect to an injury to his leg, he also had a claim that he had to go through the appeal process or actually to the RO and file a notice of disagreement with respect to PTSD. So the record, the VA record, shows that this man has consistently pursued to the best of his ability every step in the process. There's no indication that he's ever failed to send something at least to the right place, even if he sent it again, as he did with the July the 21st letter, to the wrong place.
Well, so, I look at the record. I don't see an address to the BVA in his letter. That's all.
It is. It's on the letter. It says BVA.
It says BVA.
Yes.
Right. Is there an address?
Is that BVA in California or Oregon or Idaho or Washington?
I can only assume that the fact that he put BVA on the inside of his letter is that he followed the instructions that he got, which only had one address for BVA, which was the address here in Washington.
Is that address, well, don't you have to have some indicia of sending it to the correct address?
Well,
for the mailbox room?
I don't specifically recall that, but I'm sure that's true. That only makes sense. But if the only address he had for BVA was the one in his notice that when they sent it back to him, saying, send it to the BVA here at this address in Washington.
So you purport to offer that perhaps, although it's not on the inside address on the letter, that perhaps on the envelope he has the correct address.
I would say it would have to be.
And is there any affidavit or declaration by Mr. Fithian that says that?
In his affidavit, he says he sent it to the BVA at the, I think it says at the address, but I could easily remedy that because I know when I talked to him, he said, I sent it, and I understand that this is not evidence the court can consider, but I tried to prepare his affidavit to make it clear, and if I didn't, I can certainly amend that because he says he sent it to the only address that he had. So far as I know, other than receiving the decision, he would have had no other address to send it to.
Well, let me back up for a second, Counselor, because, I mean, the mailing of the letter in July is all very interesting, but from my standpoint, there's nothing in the record that shows it was mailed or that the Secretary received it. But that kind of jumps ahead of where we were, and I'd like to go back for a second to Henderson, because in the context of the Henderson decision on page 1218, referencing the Bowles Supreme Court decision, the court says, as a result, when an appeal has not been prosecuted in the manner directed within the time limit limited by acts of Congress, and I'd like to draw your attention to the emphasis of in the manner directed and within the time limit. If you put the Henderson decision in the context of some of that language as well as the facts in Jaquay, and then you get to the conclusion of the Henderson court that says we therefore, over on page 1219, we therefore overrule our decisions in Bailey and Jaquay, it seems to me that there's certainly strong argument that, in fact, all of Bailey and Jaquay, particularly with respect to whether or not a mailing at the RO constitutes equitable tolling, that Henderson overrules Jaquay. I understand what you said earlier. In fact, I was hoping that you would be able to add clarity to my own confusion regarding what Henderson specifically offered in its opinion. But I understand that, and I share your wishes as well. But my question is, does this court have authority to determine, as we review whether or not a document is a notice of appeal, do we have authority to determine whether or not a document is a motion for reconsideration? Or should we, in the first instance, let the board, as the fact finder, make that determination?
Well, I think if the board was going to make it, yes, I think the board, I think the court should defer to the board to say whether or not it's a motion for reconsideration. In this case, the secretary filed a response that included a statement from a representative from the VA who said, we don't consider it a motion for reconsideration. So that affidavit is before the court. So to the extent that you may be asking, should we let them make the decision in the first place that they haven't made? I think they probably already have made that decision because the affidavit says we don't think it's a motion for reconsideration.
And if they make that decision, is that an appealable decision to the court?
I think it is an appealable decision to the court. If you look at Boone and you look at Cavaris and you look at Posey, in each of those instances, the court made a determination, sometimes contrary to what the VA position was, that something either was or wasn't a motion for reconsideration or wasn't a notice of appeal. So I think that's precisely the kind of legal decision that the court is charged with making, is to review that kind of decision by the VA.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Allred.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Nash? Let me just state that we acknowledge that there is a motion by the Secretary for full court in this case, and that that motion is being considered at this time, but the panel has decided to go forth as you see. So I'm very interested then, and I should ask you the first question that really is the follow-on from Judge Davis's question is, do you think we have the authority to determine whether a certain document is a motion for reconsideration?
No, Your Honor. The Secretary does not believe that the court can make that decision.
Do you think the court has the authority to determine if a decision by the board is final?
A decision
for purposes of appeal?
For the purposes of appeal, the court does have jurisdiction over decisions of the board.
But do we not have to determine if there is a final decision for which we could review?
At this juncture, Your Honor, the only question the court need answer is whether the court has a timely notice of appeal before it. And anything else...
Was it relevant to have an appeal if there's no final board decision?
It is not relevant to the court's inquiry in this case. The question before the court is whether or not appellant filed a timely NOA.
Well, we have jurisdiction over adverse final board decisions. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So if a board decision is not final, we would have no jurisdiction.
Yes, that is also correct.
And so in order to determine if a decision is final, would not the question of reconsideration be relevant?
In the event that appellant had availed himself of the procedural protections in order to get that decision to be non-final, which in the Secretary's position is not the mere filing of a request at any location for reconsideration, but as the statute says, the chairman's grant of the motion for reconsideration.
So if the chairman denies a motion, that has no effect on Rossler?
The court in Rossler, Your Honor, is the Secretary's position is beyond the bounds of its statutory authority. The statute is very clear that a board decision is final unless the chairman grants reconsideration.
I see. So, in other words, Rossler's holding then that the filing of a motion for reconsideration abates the finality of the decision is wrong?
Yes, Your Honor.
I see. And that's in one vet app, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And since one vet app, this court has done a lot of thinking and talking about finality of decisions. In DiCarlo, which was 20 vet app, the court talks about what is a final decision and how to vitiate finality. And one of the ways the court noted was the chairman's grant of a motion for reconsideration would vitiate finality. And with the development of the finality doctrine in this court.
So that means that the 120-day rule or the 120-day time period for appeal, even though a veteran files a motion for reconsideration, continues to run.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
And the chairman, if the chairman doesn't decide something within 120 days, he has really preempted the veteran's appeal?
The Secretary's position is that the protective NOA to this court would be appropriate in that circumstance.
Well, then how can the chairman act on it, then, if it's here? You'd have to seek a Cirillo remand?
Yes, Your Honor.
And when you do that, what happens?
I believe that it stayed at the court until the chairman rules.
So I see. So you're proposing that we change a lot of procedure that has been in place for 20 years?
What the secretary is suggesting is that the current procedure has gotten rather far afield from the statutory authority. And the secretary recognizes, Your Honor, that this is an area of law that continues to change. There's pending legislation addressing the 120-day rule and whether or not there can be an extension of that 120 days to file an NOA with the court. Henderson is pending before the Supreme Court.
But I'm curious about the secretary's position concerning the mere filing of a motion for reconsideration does not in any way affect the running of the period unless the chairman grants.
That's correct, Your Honor. The statute says...
So the time that the chairman is considering whether to reconsider does not render the decision stayed.
That's correct.
Or abated.
However, a protective NOA to this court would avail the veteran of a stay, or afford the veteran a stay.
Okay.
Counselor, that position sets off alarm bells to me. Number one, now you require a veteran to file a motion for consideration properly before the board, which is his or her right. Now you're going to require the veteran to file a protective NOA at this court, which sets up then a jurisdictional conflict that makes no sense from an administrative point of view, nor expeditiously processing claims. So you're going to have to convince me that interpretation is workable. And as the chief has pointed out, I think that precedent's been around for about 20 years, and I think it served everybody fairly well.
The statute, Your Honor, 7103A, predates Rossler, and Congress has imposed that limitation, that a board decision is final unless the chairman grants reconsideration.
Well, as you pointed out, Congress is reviewing these statutory ambiguities, if you will. So maybe they'll straighten it all out for everybody.
That is the hope, Your Honor.
Ms. Nash, I understand your position then to be with respect to the document that we have before us, the letter, whatever it is, that the court should only determine whether or not it is a timely filed notice of appeal. And if it is not that, then the court has no jurisdiction and should not determine whether or not it may be something else. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
So in the context of the court attempting to determine whether or not, let me put this in wildlife terminology. A baby bird is a baby bird, or it's a duck or something else. If I look at the bird and I see that perhaps it has a bill like a duck, but I can rule out the fact that it's not a roseate spoonbill.
A what?
A roseate spoonbill. I'll show you a picture of it. I shouldn't, as a court, say that it's a platypus, if it's a platypus, not a duck.
To follow the court's analogy, the only question before the court is whether or not it's a bird. What type of bird it is, if the court finds it is not a bird, then what species is not relevant. The only germane question is, does the court have jurisdiction? And that is grounded on whether or not there is a timely filed NOA. If the court answers no, there is not a timely filed NOA, then what the document is does not change the impact of what the court must do, which is dismiss for lack of jurisdiction.
So Posey went too far?
Yes, Your Honor. And Posey did dismiss. And the logic, and In the cases that looked at whether or not the document was a recon motion or not, those cases nevertheless dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, and it wasn't for any reason to do with whether the court found a motion for recon. It was because the court found there was no timely notice of appeal before it.
But the board here has already said that there's not a motion. I mean, it's not a motion for reconsideration, hasn't it?
That is correct. The board provided that response at the court's request.
And in that case, isn't the court able to review whether or not a document is a motion for reconsideration?
Allow me to correct myself. It was not the board that determined that the document was not a motion for reconsideration. That is a decision of the chairman. And decisions of the chairman are not reviewable by the court.
So the chairman decided this was not a motion for reconsideration.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's a final decision by the chairman.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is not reviewable by the court.
I'm sorry, but does that include vice chairman too?
Yes, Your Honor, the deputy vice chairman as a delegation of that authority.
How many vice chairmen are at the board?
I don't know the number, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, Judge Davis.
So once the chairman makes a determination, there is no judicial review?
That is correct, Your Honor. There's no statutory basis for jurisdiction over the acts or the decisions of the chairman. It is only over a final decision of the board.
Well, Counselor, tell me why this is not a motion for reconsideration.
With the caveat that the Secretary's position is that such an inquiry is not necessary, the reason it is not a motion for reconsideration is because it does not meet the requirements of 38 CFR 20.1000, which describes the basis for reconsideration. And that requires an allegation of error, the submission of new and material evidence within the service department records, or an allegation that benefits have been obtained by fraud or dishonesty. And the letter does not contain any of those. The procedural companion to that regulation, 20.1001, requires that one of those bases be pled in order for the motion for recon to be a valid motion for reconsideration. And here, none of those allegations were made.
Well, now, let's talk for just a moment. So if you received what I styled a motion for reconsideration, it's in letter form that says, I think the board ought to take another look at this because I don't think you did me justice. Sincerely yours, Al Lance. You're telling me that would not be a motion for reconsideration?
That's correct.
Okay. And so at what point then is the secretary or the chairman of the board obligated to advise me, say, hey, pal, this is not a motion for reconsideration?
Your Honor, upon the receipt of that letter...
After 120 days have expired?
No, Your Honor. Upon the receipt of that letter, if the board ascertains that it is not a motion for recon, it will send the veteran a letter explaining, to the extent that you've attempted to make a motion for recon, these are the filing requirements.
Okay, but when would that letter be sent? Within 3 days of receipt of my correspondence?
I don't know that there's a specific number of days.
Okay, that's the nub of the whole problem, is that if I send my letter to the board or the chairman of the board within a week after receiving my adverse decision, it's termed loosely the way that I have indicated that it would be termed, and someone, whoever someone is, does not tell me that that's not a good motion for reconsideration until 120 days from the date of the decision has elapsed, then I've lost my appellate rights. Right?
Your Honor, in that case, the Secretary would continue to advocate that the filing of a protective NOA would avoid that situation.
Well, I didn't do it. So you're telling me you'd be in there arguing that I didn't file within the 120 days, Nobody told me that my motion for reconsideration didn't meet the guidelines established by the chairman of the board or his designee, and I'm just out of luck.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, that would be the case. The time would have been.
That is the nub of the problem, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, then, I mean, how do you explain, then, if that's the case, you provide rights to appeal the decision. And where in that document do you advise the veteran that, number one, they have to file a protective NOA, or number two, that, in fact, it says, as long as you file your motion with the board within 120 days, the date this decision was mailed to you, you will then have another 120 days from the date the BVA decides the motion. It doesn't say grants or denies. It says decides the motion.
Your Honor,
If this is the advice that he had, where does the protective NOA and all that come in? Or you plan to change this?
Your Honor, that is correct with regard to how the current law stands now, and that is the instructions that this veteran was given. However, upon responding to the court's questions and looking at the issues that the court asked us to be prepared to respond to, the Secretary has come to the conclusion that from Rossler on, the law has gone in a direction beyond the bounds of the statute. And to the extent that the Secretary can offer some amount of amelioration by suggesting that a protective NOA be filed, again, we are cognizant that Congress is taking another look at this and that Henderson is pending before the Supreme Court, and that these measures may only be for the time being until either Congress or the Supreme Court speaks.
So you do believe that Henderson overruled Jockway completely, and therefore a clear motion for reconsideration filed at the RO would not be sufficient to, in Jockway's words, toll the 120-day period?
That's correct, Your Honor, because Jockway is based on the concept of a misfiled document which formed the basis for equitable tolling. Bailey was based upon missing the deadline because of assurances by a veteran service officer, also a grounds for equitable tolling. Because the Supreme Court in Bowles has said that equitable tolling is no longer available, Henderson did overrule the very basis for Jockway and Bailey, upon the very basis upon which the veteran could have tolled the time. There is no more tolling, Your Honor.
Well, Counselor, I think if you were to read Posey very closely in the concurring statements therein, what you will find is that many members of this court are troubled by the fact that the Secretary does not have any hard and fast guidance or procedures in place to return to me my hypothetical motion for reconsideration within a definite, finite period of time. And what we have seen, if you'll read the Posey decision, is that a document languishes somewhere within the Secretary's domain, and then after the 120 days have expired, magically appears this notice that this is not a motion for reconsideration or it is something else. That's the void that somebody needs to fill. And I don't know if it's the Secretary or Congress or whomever, but we're not doing justice to the veteran who believes that he or she has filed a good motion for consideration and only learns that it was not a good motion for reconsideration until after his or her 120-day appeal period has expired. That's where we're at.
Yes, Your Honor, the Secretary does share those frustrations.
Okay, well, then everybody over there ought to read Posey one more time.
Your Honor, with regard to Posey, that decision was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, as we're arguing here. However, in this case, the letter from Mr. Fithian was received by the regional office and within 3 days returned to him, advising him that if you are seeking a motion for reconsideration, this is how and where to send it. If you are seeking to appeal to the court, this is how and where to send it. Mr. Fithian elected to send it next to the court, and we're here. So in this case, the RO acted relatively quickly, within days.
Okay. And while I would commend the RO for his immediate or her immediate action, Where does the secretary mandate that immediate action be taken by all of the VA system in returning a document that may not conform to your rules and regulations?
That I cannot answer at the moment, okay. Your Honor. I'm not.
I don't think it exists.
Ms. Nash, it seems to me that this is it's an interesting problem. As Judge Lance points out, in a veteran-friendly environment, we have a department that perhaps could, by regulation or some type of guidance, simply instruct all of its divisions or agencies within that department to forward any kind of a misfiled document to the Board of Veterans Appeals. And that's precisely the issue that I think the Supreme Court has decided to grant certiorari on in Henderson, to determine whether or not in a veteran-friendly statutory scheme where it is supposed to be non-adversarial, does the Bowles principles apply in that environment, or actually do we go back to equitable tolling concepts that we had with Jequia and Bailey? It's just a little difficult for me to understand in a veteran-friendly environment the position that if you misfile in, and I understand this is a Federal Circuit decision, but if you misfile at one place within the department, that prevents you from basically filing your claim timely. It's a harsh rule that Henderson gives us, but it is the rule that we have currently. And I guess we'll all be very interested in hearing what the Supreme Court does with that. It's not a question.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Secretary's position is that the case before the court is very narrow, that there is no dispute that a timely NOA was not filed with this court, and therefore the only remedy is to dismiss.
I'm still intrigued about the, and I know we talked about the protected NOA in Rossler. I'm pretty curious about the issue of finality, because it seems to me that if the question of reconsideration is being entertained, it just seems to me that. Notwithstanding 7102 or 3, whatever it is, that we have a disconnect there. But your position is that it's only if the chairman grants reconsideration that there is an abatement of finality.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And using the same principle, I guess, at this court, if we issue a decision, we don't enter judgment until a certain time, because there's a time for reconsideration. So I guess if you are going to change your advisement of rights, it's going to be very legalistic, I take it, that you're going to tell the veteran that even though you can file your motion at any time for reconsideration, you best file a motion in 120 days, file an NOA at the court, and then wait to see what the chairman is going to do.
At the moment, Your Honor, that's what the statute requires.
To protect an NOA?
Technically, yes, Your Honor. The statute says that a board decision is final unless the chairman grants reconsideration.
Okay. I mean, I just want to make sure I understand your position.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, first of all, I did have a chance to look back at the affidavit that Mr. Pithian filed in this case. And he does say that he mailed the letter to the director of the management administration BVA here in Washington. So
that did he say he put it? Did he say he put it in the?
It says I mailed a letter, first class postage, prepaid to the director, and obviously I wrote this for him. But I mean, but it's based on what he told me, and he.
Did you check Rios before you wrote the affidavit?
No, I did. In fact, I'd never heard of Rios.
That's what surprised me when you didn't submit that today.
When I
submit that case today.
Well, I didn't get around to it. Actually, what I'd like to ask the court to do is let me submit a supplemental pleading that will include these two cases that I gave to you for your consideration within, say, 7 days.
I think we're familiar with the mailbox rule.
I'm sure you are, but I'd like to submit that to include the arguments that in part are based on particularly this one 11th Circuit case that says submitting copies of the document is the kind of extrinsic proof that can establish the mailbox rule.
Well, I'm interested in your position on the Secretary's position that really, the statute has always required that there's not abate finality of a board decision when there's a motion for reconsideration filed.
Well, my position is that the Secretary is mistaken. And this is what I base that on. That is that what the Secretary is saying is the court doesn't have jurisdiction to determine its own jurisdiction. In this case, it is in Boone, Tavares, Posey, in these cases, what the court has done is gone back and said, let's determine whether or not we have jurisdiction in this case, and the way we can determine whether or not we have jurisdiction is to look at the underlying events that occurred before or contemporaneous with the motion to appeal. And I think that's really what we're asking the court to do here. I can't say that the regulations specifically state that the court has power to review the chairman's decision whether there's a motion for reconsideration. If that's a hard binding rule on the court, then as members of the panel have pointed out, it does a serious injustice not just to veterans, but it creates a big hole in how the court can even operate. Because what the Secretary's position is, it's similar to Catch-22, which is we can't look at those decisions or those actions that might affect our jurisdiction because we have no jurisdiction to look at those actions or decisions that affect our jurisdiction. So, you know, the law is what the law is. I just find it hard to believe that the law provides for that kind of gap in providing the kind of review that obviously Congress had in mind when it set up the court.
Counselor, has your client ever been advised that his motion for reconsideration was denied?
No, he has not.
And has your client ever been advised that the motion for reconsideration was defective in as much as it did not provide certain information or allegations?
The letter that when he got the materials returned to him is the Secretary says 3 days after he sent it to the RO. I don't recall that letter said, here's what the problem is. And I also find it, when they sent it back to him, it said, you can file it with the BVA or you can file an appeal. Mr. Fithian, I don't know, I haven't talked to him about this, but my guess is he said, already filed the motion with the BVA and nothing happened. Now I guess I'll file an appeal. This man is not an well-educated, he's not a lawyer. He's doing the absolute best he can to pursue his claim against the VA. So when he gets this letter back in September saying, file it with the BVA or file it with the Court of Appeal, he's looking at this stuff. He said, I already filed it with the BVA and didn't hear anything from them. That's why I sent it to the RO. To try to hear something to get them to reconsider. And so then he files a motion, files a notice of appeal with this court. So I think he's done everything that he possibly could to comply with the rules and regulations. And again, I urge the court to look at that July the 31st record, July the 21st, although now I understand that the secretary's position is it doesn't matter whether he actually sent it or not, because our position is Rossler doesn't count. So I'm thinking that the court's going to find that's just not, that can't possibly be the fact, be the case, because it creates such a huge gap in the chance for the court to do what Congress has charged the court to do. So, you know, I would say the July 21st letter should be considered a motion for reconsideration that falls within the mailbox rule. And again, if the court gives permission, I could file within just a few days a clear statement of what my argument is, that it relies in part on these two cases.
Mr. Allred, let me just try to clarify your answer to a question Judge Lance asked regarding your client has never received
That's true.
A letter or indication from the chairman of the board indicating that his motion for reconsideration or the letter he submitted was not a motion for reconsideration or was not granted. Is that accurate?
That is true. I read yesterday the letter that the VA, that the RO sent back to him. And I think all it said was, we're returning these materials because there's nothing we can do in here, and you can either send it to the VA. I'm certain they didn't explain to him that it was defective, because I would have certainly noticed that. So I'm certain they have never...
Defective or denied?
Either one. It didn't say either one. So what I'm asking the court to do is to remand the case to the Veterans Administration to consider this motion for reconsideration, to consider this letter as being a motion for reconsideration, and to do that without prejudice to his right to appeal in the future, based on the fact that the July 21 letter falls within the mailbox rule. And again,
Counselor, with regard to your request that I think the Chief Judge has responded to for additional time and supplemental pleadings, submission of non-binding precedent from the 9th and the 11th Circuit is not going to do much for the court, and we already have a case called Rios that I believe all the judges
yes.
are familiar
right.
with.
Yes, right, right. Okay, all right.
Don't
conference, if we decide that we need any supplemental briefing, we will so order.
Unless the court has additional questions, I don't think I have anything else that I can provide.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. We will greet counsel at the bar, and the court will adjourn.
All rise.
Towards the end, recess.